the Israeli occupation army committed massacres against the families in North Gaza and in north of the Strip. Many bodies of the martyrs are now boiling up in the corridors and in the morgues of Ashifa hospitals. Around 24 Palestinians were killed since midnight until now. In many horrific massacres, Israeli occupation army committed against mainly three families: Al-Haddad family, Mohsin family, and Dogmosh family. One family, Dogmosh family, was targeted. The building or the residential building of Dogmosh family was targeted, and that resulted in the killing of 16 of the same family. The same family also was subjected to another massacre yesterday that resulted in the killing of 8 of them. And that again highlights how the Israeli occupation army is stalking the survivors and stalking the families in their destinations and in their displacement shelters again and again.
Many Palestinians have been forced to leave Gaza City as the Israeli regime ramps up its large-scale military operations there. Families are seen moving south along the coastal Wadi Gaza route, some in trucks and others pushing carts with belongings. Let's listen to some of them to see how they feel.
We are headed toward the unknown. We are headed south to the unknown. Nobody knows where they are going. Are we going back to Gaza or not? Allah knows. The circumstances are hard, and life is hard. Everything in Gaza is hard beyond description.
The situation is hard and there are no life necessities. No water, electricity, or internet. People are forced to leave with nothing. They target us with things that you wouldn't imagine, like science fiction. They target us with missiles that we have never heard of.
We were crying all the way, for our country and for what happened to us. We feel sad for ourselves and for our children, they cry a lot. We cry for the martyrs we left under the rubble and our relatives we couldn't save.
Well, we are now joined by Mr. Frahius, who is aboard the humanitarian flotilla heading for Gaza. The activists on the International Samud Flotilla seek to break the Israeli-imposed blockade on Gaza and deliver aid to the famine-stricken Palestinians there. Mr. Hughes, as always, like to thank you very much for joining us. Where exactly have we reached in the Mediterranean Sea? Is there an expected duration? How many days to reach there and hopefully break the Gaza siege? And have you encountered any more attacks since the last few days since we spoke?
Well, just to confirm, I mean, we're in the Mediterranean Sea. The flotilla is all coming together. And then together as one unit, I believe we might have up to 50 ships that are going to go forward on this sojourn to try and create a humanitarian maritime lifeline to Gaza. So the original timeline has been stretched. So many boats, such an organization for headache for the steering committee. We did travel through some bad storms, which created the need for some repairs. But we're all together, we're all going forward, and hopefully we will reach Gaza in several days now.
And Mr. Hughes, I mean, at the beginning, there was an expected amount of ships to be joining this very large flotilla at the moment. Is the joining of even more ships at the time, did it come to any surprise to those volunteers already aboard the flotilla ships?
Yes, well, the morale is very, very, very high here. I mean, I don't know exactly how many participants we have, but it could be, if there's 50 ships, you go for 10 per ship, you're talking about over 500 people, maybe 600 people taking this journey. But all our eyes are focused on Gaza. All our eyes are witnessing the continuing destruction, devastation, genocidal ethnic cleansing of Gaza. So no matter what challenges the flotilla faces going forward, we are very much, our hearts, minds and thoughts are with the Palestinians in Gaza and indeed the West Bank and indeed the wider region for people who are suffering from oppression, suffering from continued violence being offered by the Zionist state.
And Mr. Hughes, this is not the first ship attempting to break the siege on Gaza. The previous volunteers aboard those ships have previously been detained by the Zionist entity, later released. When it comes to what might happen, whether detained, whether actually being able, as everyone's hoping, to break the siege, if the siege is not broken with, as you're mentioning, at least 50 ships, is there plan B? Because some people have mentioned that if this doesn't work, what can work?
Well, plan A is to get to Gaza. I mean, that's why I'm on this flotilla. It's interesting in a way that I remember the murders and the martyrdom of the Shaheeds that were on the Mamavi Mara in 2010, and that actually led me on my first step on the road to solidarity with the Palestinian cause. I was on a land convoy, George Galloway-inspired Viva Palestina 5, September-October 2010, and yet here I am, 15 years later, on a flotilla, following in the footsteps of the Mavi Marmara. We don't know what's going to happen. I have no control over what these Zionist folks and mercenaries might do to the flotilla. But I must stress, we're watching what's happening in Gaza. No matter what happens to us, it's only a microcosm of the daily and hourly suffering of the Palestinians in Gaza. If there is a forced violent interception of the flotilla, we are following international law. We are following the Fourth Geneva Convention to try and prevent genocide by creating a maritime lifeline to Gaza. They stopped the boats before. They incarcerated people who were compliant with international law, kidnapped in international waters, thrown into the dungeons of the Israeli judicial system. It didn't stop the flotilla. There's been boat after boat after boat. Now there's 50 boats. This is some headache for the Israelis. They have 45 surface boats. We have 50 ships. I'm more interested in the Egyptian-Turkish military naval exercises that are taking part. Will they continue on past the 26th of September in order to protect the flotilla, or are they just flexing their muscles in order to show some form of deterrent to further Israeli aggression and the potential of exiling people from Gaza into the Sinai? I publicly call on the Egyptian government, I publicly call on Erdogan to keep your ships in the Med, to offer protection to the flotilla. I do this not in hope that they will do it. I do it in order to call out their shameful past acquiescence to the Zionist state, which includes the closing of the Rafah border crossing and Turkey's continuation to sell steel and oil and other commodities that are used in the war effort by Israel against the Palestinian people. So I'm calling them out, defend the flotilla or show the world that you're cowards in the face of Zionist aggression.
Exactly. Well, we all wish you all best of hope. Of course, thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Frau Hughes, journalist, author, and activist. They're joining us from the Mediterranean Sea. In Mexico, protesters gather outside the Israeli embassy in the capital of Mexico City to protest the regime's war on Gaza and their government's weak reaction to the genocide unfolding in the besieged Strip. Holding banners and chanting slogans in support of Palestinians, they called on Mexico City to sever ties with Tel Aviv. The demonstrators denounced their government for failing to send a strong message in support of the Palestinians in Gaza. They also criticized the international community for its inaction over what's happening in the Gaza Strip, which is facing a humanitarian crisis due to 2 years of Israel's genocidal war. Well, Britain and Portugal are expected to recognize a Palestinian state today, ahead of a key week at the UN's gathering where a group of nations are set to do the same to pressure Israel over Gaza. According to British media, Prime Minister Keir Starmer is set to announce the policy shift. Portugal's foreign ministry also confirmed on Friday that it will officially declare its recognition on Sunday. World leaders will convene in New York this week for a high-stakes debate at the UN, where the two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will take center stage. France and Canada are among other Western nations expected to endorse Palestinian statehood in the coming days. Israel, which opposes the move, has threatened to assert full control over the West Bank in response. Our correspondent Alqat Hamad joined us earlier from Ramallah for the latest on the situation in the occupied West Bank. She said the Israeli military and settlers have intensified raids across the Palestinian territory.
More raids are being documented inside Al-Aqsa Mosque, and as I have mentioned, that the Israeli forces will be redeploying two battalions toward the occupied West Bank. Most of the cities of the West Bank, Bahman, was raided throughout the night, not only Jenin. And Jenin has been witnessing a surge in violence. Of course, we are well aware that it's almost 300 days of relentless aggression by the military operation, the Iron Wall. Yes, but for the latest 2 months, we have seen the situation in Jenin was calming down a little bit, but now we are seeing it to go back towards more raids. Since the hours of the morning, groups of settlers are attacking Palestinians in the village of Deir Jirir to the northeast of Ramallah. Deir Jirir has lost recently, lost a Palestinian martyr from settler violence, which has the Palestinian Muhammad Adawi was directly shot by Israeli settlers while three others were injured. The Israeli settlers from the newly established Atara illegal outpost have attacked the Palestinians in Atara and attacked specifically one Palestinian man who was driving his car doing his job in the area, severely beat him, and now he is being hospitalized.
Well, Yemen's top military commanders have issued a serious warning to the country's enemies, especially Israel, pledging severe retaliation for any aggression against the Arab nation. The warning came through a joint statement by Yemen's Defense Minister, Major General Mohammad Al-Atifi, and Chief of Staff, Major General Mohammad Al-Ghamari. They said Yemen possesses advanced military capabilities that enable it to deliver precise and painful strikes against all enemies. They stressed that in the view of Yemen's military strength, no aggression against the country will go unpunished, and aggressors will pay a heavy price. The generals reaffirmed that Yemen's support for the Palestinians in Gaza will continue with full force. They emphasized that Yemen's anti-Israel operations will continue in nearby waters and also in the occupied territories until Israel's war on Gaza ends and the siege of the territory is lifted. Our correspondent Yusuf Mawdi joined us earlier from Yemen's capital Sana'a to provide us with more details on the statement issued by the country's top military commanders.
The escalation of military airstrikes against Israel continue to escalate and continue to increase, continue to advance, and continue to accelerate at a pace we've never seen before in history. Now, the speech, there was a couple of speeches today given by a number of Ansar Allah officials and government officials and military officials, basically praising the September 21st revolution. This is the revolution that toppled the U.S.-backed Ali Abdullah Saleh regime from power and ushered the way for the Ansar Allah movement to take over the country and to begin focusing on gaining independence and sovereignty on the nation. They claim and they say and they praise this revolution for being the revolution that will start and initiate the end of the Israeli regime. So far, this revolution, what it has achieved is bring a permanent end to all Israeli shipping in the Red Sea. This is a part of the success of the September 21st Yemeni revolution that was launched in 2014, and we see the fruits of it today as the resistance, the Islamic resistance led by the Ansar Allah continues to advance with new sophisticated advanced military weapons, reaching hypersonic speed, reaching drone missiles and ballistic missiles that are able to penetrate Israeli air defense systems, that are able to hit Israeli targets in the Red Sea, in the Arabian Sea.
Well, that's all we have for you for this hour. Goodbye for now.
Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, we start this episode of today's special by the name of Allah Almighty. And then we say salam to all of you, dear brother and sister, dear listener of this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. So welcome and wait, we're going to speak about etiquette of lending money.
Thank you.
today is Sunday, 28th of Rabiul Awal, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 30th of the month of Shahrivar, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 21st of September, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. We listen to chapter At-Taghabun, verses 17 to 18. We'll learn more about these verses.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. In tuqridu Allah qardan hasanan yudha'ifhu lakum wa yaghfir lakum. Wallahu shakurun halim.
If you loan Allah a goodly loan, He will multiply it for you and forgive you. And Allah is most appreciative and forbearing.
عالم الغيب والشهادة العزيز الحكيم.
Knower of the unseen and the witnessed, the exalted in might, the wise.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The blessed verse is saying that God Almighty is all aware of seen and the unseen, and He is the omnipotence, the all-wise. Allah Almighty is all aware of what His servants do in private and in public. He is omniscient of what they expend in His cause. If He asks them to lend Him a goodbye loan, it does not reflect His need and lack powerlessness. Rather, such request indicates His infinite affection and grace. Such grace rewards in return for expending in His cause reflect His wisdom. Therefore, the five divine attributes mentioned in the blessed verse in question and the preceding one are all related to the encouragement to expend in His cause. Today we continue speaking about the etiquette of lending money, which was started from the previous episode of today's special. Islam places great importance on the proper procedures for debt and credit. It's a social responsibility that must be conducted with the right adab, that means proper manners. If our intention is to help, then it must be sincere. Debt should not become a tool to pressure someone in a vulnerable situation. People who owe money are often already in a position of need and urgency. Debt and credit in Islam are governed by a binding contract and guided by sincere intentions. Both borrowers and lenders are expected to uphold ethical practices that promote mutual benefit rather than sowing discord.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to today's special. This is Ali, your host. We shall be talking about the etiquettes of lending and borrowing in Islam. In the Quranic verses, the primary party to whom the loan is given is God Himself, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and no verse specifies a particular person. This indicates the importance of divine intention in Qard al-Hasana, because A good loan is one that comes from lawful wealth and is not spoiled by causing annoyance or placing obligation. In truth, this act should be performed without material expectation and solely for the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, specifically, how is Qard al-Hasan looked in Quranic verses? The Holy Quran refers to the concept of Qard al-Hasan in multiple verses, introducing it as a worthy and virtuous act. In Surah Al-Hadid, verse 11, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala states, من ذا الذي يقرض الله قرضا حسنا فيضاعفه له وله أجر كريم. Meaning, who is that would loan Allah a goodly loan, so he will multiply it for him and he will have a noble reward. This verse shows that Qard al-Hasana not only has a multiplied reward, but also grants the lender a noble status before the Lord. In other words, this act is a form of spiritual investment guaranteed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio.
May this moment last forever in your hearts, a day you'll always remember every bar.
Today's a special.
This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life. Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time.
This is today's a special, and these are steps to take before you lend money. Make sure the borrower knows the loan is not a gift. Before you provide someone with the loan, ensure they understand the money is not a gift. This understanding is essential in getting your money back and maintaining a good relationship with the borrowers. In addition, when it comes to taxes, loans and gifts are treated very differently. Gifts are subject to a gift tax. Gift tax is a tax on transfers of money or property to other people while getting nothing or less than full value in return. So if you loan someone over some amount and they don't pay it back, it can be considered a gift and create tax complications. Islamic perspective on debt is the title of this part. One of the foundational elements in Islamic financial ethics is the prohibition of riba, or usury, or interests. This reflects, among many other things, the Islamic principle of social justice, ensuring that the burden of risk is not disproportionately placed on the borrower and preventing exploitative lending practices. Here, the Sharia protects the borrowers and debtors. The Sharia encourages lenders to go easy with debtors. And in fact, Sharia promotes helping those struggling with interest-free loans as well as grants. Sharia is a perfect balance. How? Whilst it has guidance addressed to the creditor to guide their conduct, Sharia also protects creditors and lenders and has guidance addressed to borrowers and debtors. The guidance shows how Sharia balances the rights and ensures everyone's rights are upheld.
Also, in verse 245 of Surah Al-Baqarah, it is stated, من ذا الذي يقرض الله قرضا حسنا فيضاعفه له أضعافا كثيرة والله يقبض ويبسط وإليه ترجعون. Who is that would loan Allah a goodly loan, so he will multiply it for him many times over? And it is Allah who withholds and grants abundance, and to him you would be returned. This verse clearly states that Qardul Hasan is an act that not only begins blessing into the lender's life, but is also guaranteed to be repaid by Allah with a reward many times multiplied. This Quranic emphasis indicates that the lender should not expect material profit. Their main goal should be divine satisfaction. And how about the narrations? How is it look at the language of narrations? In the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, the importance of lender is also emphasized. These narrations not only point to the spiritual reward for a loan, but also consider it superior to charity or sadaqah. Imam Sadiq, alayhi salam, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, said, on the gate of paradise, it is written that lending has 18 times the reward and charity has 10 times. This narration shows that the higher value of a loan compared to charity or sadaqah. The reason is that Qardul Hasana gives the needy person an opportunity to solve their financial problem without humiliation and dependency, and in the future repay it without feeling indebted. In contrast, charity or sadaqah is one way help that might involve a sense of dependency for the recipient.
Thank you, dear brother and sister, for listening to this episode of today's special, in which we spoke about the etiquette of lending money. Shall we follow this topic? Till the next time, fi amanillah.
Show me all kind of lies. My eyes were like, yes, I was mesmerized. But deep inside I know that there's a better world. Cause I'm a believer. I'm a believer.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Fabian Zuleg, the Chief Executive Officer of the European Policy Centre, based here in Brussels, one of the most prestigious think tanks in the EU. Thank you very much for your time. I know you're a very busy man with a big team. In relation to the State of the Union 2025 address this week from the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, it was the first time we've heard her speak tough about Israel. And she talked about the possibility of sanctions against ministers and so on, and suspending parts of the trade agreement. Why do you think her stance on this subject has changed?
Well, there has been an accumulation of different things. Certainly, there has been a lot of pressure on her. But I think what is also very significant is that the opinion has been shifting at the domestic level. And in some of the big countries, the leaders were becoming more critical of Israel. So in a sense, she has tried to catch up with where the debate overall was at that moment in time. But of course, there are still big divisions within Europe. Different countries have very different takes. So she also acknowledged that some people will think she's not going far enough, and some people will think she's gone too far.
Why do you think it is that we do see so much division in the EU on the subject of Israel?
I think we have to look at two dimensions. I mean, firstly, it is normal that there are these divisions. We have 27 different countries which have very different foreign policy stances, and we shouldn't forget that foreign policy is not one of the main areas of European coordination. Every country has their own policy and has also differing opinions on particularly issues which are as intractable as the Middle East, where for a very long time there hasn't really been a convincing solution on the table. But the other element, and that also has to do with how the European Union is set up, even those countries which might agree with the Commission President or with other parts of the European institutions very often object to the European Union becoming involved in these discussions because they don't see that this is a role for the European level to have a foreign policy stance.
Yeah, but we see the EU is now preparing its 19th round of sanctions, tough sanctions against Russia, and yet no sanctions so far against Israel. Like, why do you think that is? Is it the argument that, you know, Ukraine is in Europe, or is it the fact some people talk about the very powerful Israel lobby that has an influence over the decisions that are taken here?
I would actually argue that Russia is the exception. It normally is difficult to get agreement between the member states when it comes to foreign policy issues. Just having seen, for example, the incursion into Polish airspace very much highlights that this is something which affects all of us. So in that area, it is much, much easier to get consensus to move forward. Yes, there will be one or two countries which object, one or two governments which object, because they always object. But in principle, there's a vast majority which supports that action. When it comes to Israel, when it comes to other parts of the world, there are far greater divisions. In part, that also has to do with history and the specific history of some countries with the countries involved. But more generally, it's just more difficult to get agreement, as we also see, for example, when it comes to China.
Well, the day before Ursula von der Leyen delivered the State of the Union address, there was a debate in the European Parliament on the situation in Gaza. And what you see there is a big chunk of the MEPs, the members of the European Parliament, the EU lawmakers, they are very far right. They support Netanyahu. They're very far right in their views. Why do you think it is that we're seeing the rise of the far right in the EU?
It is a long-term trend. We have seen the far right strengthening over time. In many ways, these are anti-parties. They don't really have solutions. They don't have programs. But they know what they are against, which is also a feature of how democratic discourse is developing. It's much easier now on social media to just simply be against certain issues and to get coalitions together which can block things. I think what we have seen in the United States is also a phenomenon over here, and we shouldn't underestimate how much the developments in the States will also fuel some of those divisions within Europe. Clearly, there are a number of far-right organizations which refer to Trump, which think that the Trumpian agenda is exactly what it is needed. And I think we are going to see that it very much mixes with some of the big topics. I mean, clearly migration has always been one of the breeding grounds for the far right. But we're also seeing increasingly it's about climate change and the measures which are there. It is about the war and supporting Ukraine. Very often couched in terms of even if this is something which needs to be done, we shouldn't be the ones who are paying for it.
And Fabian, another thing that Ursula von der Leyen mentioned in her State of the Union address is in relation to the cost of living crisis. I mean, prices are so high here in the EU for rents, for food. You know, we've just seen a massive price increase over the last few years. Do you think, we mentioned the far right earlier, do you think that is why that could lead to a further expansion and rise of the far right?
I mean, certainly we live in much more challenging times. That's economically, that's socially. We are now in a period where for the first time really in European integration history, there's a realistic chance that the next generations are going to be worse off than current ones. And that creates a lot of political problems. In many areas, we now have to distribute costs. It's not about the benefits from working together, but it's actually about saying, how do we pay for defense? How do we pay for the green transition? How do we pay for all the different areas where we need to invest in the next few years? So it's a much more difficult political environment. And yes, many people are feeling that their life is getting worse, that they are not as secure, as stable, that they see prices rising. But the difficulty is that many of these are trends which are beyond the control of our governments or of the European Union. And the right-wing populists promise a lot, but there is no way they can fulfill these promises. And it's interesting, we've seen it with the example of Brexit, we've seen it now starting with the example of Trump. These promises do not lead to better outcomes for their population. In fact, they lead to worse outcomes, but it's very hard to counter them before they get into power.
Can I ask you as well about EU-US relations? Because obviously there's been a lot of tensions on issues like trade since Trump came back to the White House. How would you assess at the moment? There are differences on foreign policy. There are obviously issues in relation to trade. And what else could happen, we don't know. But how would you assess relations at the moment between the United States and the European Union?
Relations between, I would say, the White House and the European Union are very bad. In many ways, Trump is opposed to the concept of the European Union. He doesn't like multilateralism. He doesn't like cooperation between states. He believes in a world where power matters. And if you are stronger, you can do whatever you want. He doesn't care about allies. He cares about who he sees as important people. So it is about people like Putin, and it is about those who fawn over him, who suggest that he will get the Nobel Prize, and so on. So this is anathema to how Europe works. It is a real threat to our democracy, because of course there are influences of that on our debates, on our parties. But in the background is always this dependence of Europe on security as well. And that's why we also had to accept a deal, which is a very bad deal for Europe, but there were only bad choices on the table.
And when you say a bad deal for Europe, do you think that the European Commission, the institutions, the EU leaders could have pushed back harder against Trump on this issue?
Of course, we had the choice to push back harder. The question is, what would the consequences be of that? And we have already seen that Trump is very willing to put security on the table as well. And that is a risk which Europe at the moment cannot run because we are too dependent on the United States and Ukraine is too dependent on the United States. So what we had to accept in the end comes directly out of our weakness.
Can we afford more military spending in the European Union? We do have, if you look at the Eurostat data, we have a huge number of people at risk of poverty or in poverty. We've had, you know, increased spending in NATO, and most of the NATO members are also members of the EU in terms of the countries. And then additionally, more military spending within the EU itself. So billions upon billions being spent on weapons, and people argue not enough on social justice. So can we afford all this military spending?
I think we don't have a choice. There are imperatives which we have to fulfill, and defense has to be one of the key areas which we spend money on. And it is an area where also you will need a lot of public money. It is not something where you can rely on the private sector. But then I think it is also a question of seeing what is it actually we are spending on. There is a lot of money in the 5% target, which is also about infrastructure. It's about developing what will also help the private economy. It's not only about military. I would also argue that we can benefit a lot from this additional spending in the defense sector if we think about it in the right way, if we coordinate in Europe, if we don't buy all of these weapons from elsewhere. I think there are many things which we can do. But in the end, it's also not only about amounts of money. It's not about the figure which we are going to put in the end to convince Trump that we have done what we said we would do. It's about how well we are spending it. And I think this is the biggest challenge we have in Europe. When we look at how much we collectively spend, it is vastly more than Russia. But we are not very effective in how we spend it. So we need to find ways of getting better at spending that money. And that also means doing more things together. One of the big challenges, and I think that goes right through the State of the Union in almost every policy area, is that we now live in a world where the need to work together at the European level is greater than ever. Many of the challenges will not be addressed unless we do it together. But the political reluctance to really work together, to put competences at the European level, is greater than ever. So we have a paradox.
Can I ask you as well, you know, one of the big policy achievements of the European Union was to create the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA nuclear deal with Iran. And Trump in his first term tore that up. Now we don't know where we stand in terms of diplomacy and nuclear talks with Iran. Is there any hope of resurrecting the JCPOA, in your opinion, or creating a new accord? What are your feelings or what are your thoughts on that?
Certainly, the deal with Iran was groundbreaking, and it was very much Europeans in the driving seat, working out what could be done. But it was already very much damaged after Trump tore it up in his first presidency. And now with the attacks on Iran by Israel, it's very hard to see also what the Iranian side is going to do. Clearly, there was a decision taken, I would argue, not only in Israel, but also in Washington, that military force would be more effective. Now it remains to be seen whether that's true, whether this has really damaged Iranian capabilities in the long run. It has increased the volatility, But we can't just go back to the old deal. That time has passed forever.
And in your view, could the EU side have done more to save the JCPOA nuclear accord? Could they be doing more now diplomatically in terms of trying to secure a new agreement?
It seems to be that at this moment in time, some of the key actors within the Middle East are entirely ignoring Europe. So if the United States, if Israel do not listen, it's very hard to see how Europe could play a broker role, because clearly you would have to have also concessions from those countries. So at the moment, I think it is very difficult to see any way forward. And I would actually argue that what we have seen over the last month is a significant deterioration in the Middle East, which will destabilize for a long time to come, because even long-standing issues like the two-state solution for Palestine is looking even further away than it did before.
Do you think there's any hope of a two-state solution at this stage?
At this stage, no. At this stage, there is no willingness to even start negotiating. But I would also say that all the actions which are being taken now are running counter to the idea of a two-state solution. So it's very hard to see how we will even return to the status quo before all of these attacks.
Yeah. And do you think that, like, even with the recent attack on Qatar, an independent sovereign state, and we saw the attack by Israel on Iran, and the United States also attacking Iran, but in terms of Israel's position, do you feel there's a move away from Israel in the EU, given that we've seen an escalation and attacks on sovereign countries? I know he has a lot, Benjamin Netanyahu and the government have a lot of support, for example, in the European Parliament with the far right. But generally speaking, at government level, EU institution level, is there a move away from Netanyahu?
I think what we've seen also in the reaction to the bombing in Qatar is that this is breaking the kind of guardrails which for many countries are just a step too far. Will that change his behavior? Well, that really depends on the big supporter. It depends on the United States. And there the question is whether, yes, we've seen a bit of condemnation, but whether that condemnation will actually be followed with concrete steps or whether it simply is talk. Unfortunately, my guess would be that Trump is not willing to do anything decisive, which means that Benjamin Netanyahu will just continue doing what he's doing.
More generally speaking, Fabian, can I ask you about what you see the future of the European Union being? I mean, the euro area is expanding shortly. In January, Bulgaria will join the euro. There are many countries that want to join the European Union, full stop, and they'll automatically join the euro in that case. But is there a danger that the EU could expand too quickly to bring in countries that might turn against the project in the long run, as we might have seen here at the moment, for example, perhaps with Hungary and a couple of others? So in terms of the future of the EU, what are your thoughts on that?
I think we should be very careful that we're not nostalgic about the European Union and what it might have been in the past. Because the reality is that we are seeing challenges also in the member states, which were there from the beginning. What will happen, for example, if we have a far-right French president, which I would say is a very realistic possibility at this moment in time. We see that far-right parties, anti-European parties, are strong in the polls in Germany. So this is something where I think we have to be very careful not to paint a too idealistic picture of what the current EU is like. We have to bring in the countries which are waiting. Enlargement should not be something which is even in question, because the geopolitics, the geoeconomics mean that we have to bring these in. if we do not bring in Ukraine, it will not be safe, which has implications for all of us. If we do not bring in the Western Balkans, other countries will step in and will dominate politics there. So we have to do it, but what we have to do at the same time is also make the reforms necessary to make a union function with 30 plus members. And that's where we didn't see anything in the State of the Union. There was no realistic idea of how do we actually move from the union as it is now to the one which we need to have to address the challenges, including also bringing in the countries which are waiting to come in.
And is that a failure in terms of her vision, Ursula von der Leyen's vision, or is she just merely peddling the views of and the feelings and the stance of the EU leaders and the EU institutions, or is it a personal failure in terms of having the foresight on her part?
I would argue both. Yes, she is reflecting where the debate is on enlargement and reform, but it is also a question of her not putting forward a stronger vision, not putting forward concrete steps to say this is what we should be doing next. But clearly, the blame does not only lie with the Commission President or with the institutions. The key question here is how willing are our governments to do the policy changes which are necessary to address the fundamental challenges which we all have, but which are difficult and at times politically costly.
Fabian Zuleg, CEO of the European Policy Centre, thank you very much for your time today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My life has been a journey where faith is where I roam. Footsteps I used to walk in don't really match mine no more. I live south for the river where children are quick to grow. Walking down the street full of distraction for some they call it home. So take me home. Everything you say comes true. You love an affection.